The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
That's the way he ran the law firm. That's the way he practiced law. That's the way he dealt with people. And it was extraordinary.
John Romano shares the thrill of working for the legendary Al Cohn and his own approach to law and to life.
I am Pollyanna. I do look for the good in everybody. I look for the positive in every situation. And in my life, no matter what has gone wrong, no matter how horrible something may have happened, I still say, we're going to turn it into something positive. We can, we do, we always will.
And about his concerns about the future practice of trial law.
We are in a time where we're seeing people who recently can be appointed to the bench, where these individuals may have never taken a deposition, tried a case, handled hearings. They never had to get down in the ditches and use a shovel in the practice of law.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I am Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. His first boss and mentor was Al J. Cohn, the founder of the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers, the predecessor of the Florida Justice Association. As such, our conversation with John Romano of Lake Worth is as much the story and lessons of the legendary Al Cohn as it is of John's career. He learned well, as you'll hear. John Romano is a past president of the Florida Justice Association and a recipient of the Perry Nichols Award, the FJA's most prestigious award. But John is best known as the founder and leader of the FJA's annual Workhorse Seminar. And John is just as much an inspiring coach as he is an accomplished trial lawyer. His approach to his practice is based on his approach to his family. For John, it's one big tapestry of love. While he shares his motto for running a successful law practice, this podcast is more about lessons of life and love. But it's that love that John applies so well to his practice of law, as Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett discovered in this May 2019 conversation.
John, you have a long and storied career with the Florida Justice Association. I'm looking forward to asking you about that. But one of your most recent awards was the John Krupnik Award from the FJA for your tenacious and unwavering commitment to obtaining justice for one of your clients. It was a Sergeant James Stanley, who was a 22-year-long legal battle that you waged against the U.S. government. That's a case that really helped define your career, didn't it?
It really did, and it was such an honor to receive that award because I've known John Krupnik all of the time that I've been practicing law, and he's a remarkable human being and just an extraordinary trial lawyer. An amazing thing that a lot of people don't know about that case, though, is that the day that I came back home to West Palm Beach to go to work in private practice following my active duty with the U.S. Marine Corps, I went to work for Al Cohn's firm. Al Cohn was the founder and first president of FJA, then called the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers. On that day, two partners, Al Cohn and Ward Wagner, each one handed me a case. Al Cohn gave me the Stanley case. Ward Wagner gave me a case where a young child had just been killed by a crocodile down at the Miami Serpentarium. In the Stanley case, as soon as I reviewed the case, I met with the client, and I became fascinated with the whole idea of them, our own government, giving LSD to soldiers without them knowing about it as a trick. And they said the reason for this program, it was called Project MKUltra, the reason was they were trying to figure out how to control the minds of Soviet spies and Chinese spies. So they figured, we'll give them LSD. So what they did was said, well, let's test it. We'll do human experimentation on prisoners. They said, no, that won't work because we'll get skewed results. They said, let's do it on mental patients. Nope, we'll get skewed results. So they said, we're going to have to give it on to the kind of people who will become spies. But those kind of people, if we tell them ahead of time, they'll never take this drug, unless maybe if they were college students, they might have. So they gave it to these soldiers, and Sergeant Stanley, who was married and had 6 children, his life went into an extraordinarily horrible tailspin, including a gentle type of a man who became violent and had a raging temper. It destroyed his career. And I filed that lawsuit, and we ended up going to the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, the 11th Circuit twice, and to the U.S. Supreme Court. And although we kept winning at the trial court level, and even in the mid-level appellate courts, when we get to the Supreme Court, we had a 5-4 decision against us, but an extraordinary dissent from Justice Brennan, who commented on human experimentation, and shouldn't we have learned lessons from World War II? How can we be doing this ourselves? So ultimately, we filed a private claims bill in Congress. We tried the case in 1997 on Court TV, and we prevailed in the case and recovered for the client. It took 22 years.
Wow. How did that impact your career?
It simply reinforced the concept of when you really believe something or you believe in something, go for it, even though others will tell you no. Do something easier, something with fewer hurdles, with fewer obstacles. And then once you do it, it's like the old saying we used to hear from Professor Mickey Smiley at Stetson Law School, where he says, be careful for when you mount a tiger. For once you mount the tiger, you need to stay on until the tiger's dead. And the lesson I learned is that's what you do in cases like that. You stick with it no matter what. And you try and you try and you try. And we did, and we finally prevailed and had a happy client.
Wow. 22 years, though. That's extraordinary.
It was.
Although others have said about you, have described you as passionate, unusually devoted, a reputation for attracting unusual cases. And that certainly was one of them, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. And that's true. I must say, I do like not only challenging cases, but cases that are very different, very unique, to where you have to use your imagination, you have to be creative, you have to be innovative. I love those kind of cases.
Now, you mentioned before you got into law or civil law, you were with the military, you were a JAG officer, U.S. Marines, FSU undergrad, the South Texas College of Law in Houston, JD. Let's backtrack, though. What first got you interested in even going into law?
When I was a kid and growing up, I pretty much had my eyes on either being a doctor or a lawyer or a teacher and coach. If somebody were to say to me right now, if you were not practicing law and you were to go into another career, what would you do? I would want to coach and teach. I had a professor at Florida State, Professor Horwood, who would come in, he taught history. And I definitely could say that I was not somebody who cared a lot about learning history until I met him. And each class, he would come in to the classroom dressed as the main character of that particular time period he would be teaching us about. So if we were talking about Napoleon, he would come in with this extraordinary costume, and he would talk with a French accent, and it would be in the first person as if he was Napoleon. He taught every class like that. And the more I saw that, the more I began to see what persuasion is all about and advocacy. And then I started to think more and more about law. And we had some lawyers come onto the campus at Florida State. You know, it was a very activist time in the 60s. And I was just blown away by them. And I went, that's it. I'm going to law school. And all I wanted to do is criminal defense.
Wow. And you did, and you've represented people on trial for murder, violent crimes.
Yes.
But
I've been both a prosecutor and a criminal defense lawyer. And then as the years went by, more and more it was personal injury and wrongful death.
From what you've said, it sounds like a lot of law or a lot of effective law advocacy is based on storytelling.
It is based on storytelling. Sure. It is being able to go into another person's mind or brain and evoke in them a desire to accept something as important, to accept it as true, as accurate, as meaningful in their lives as well as the lives of others. And that's why to be able to explain something in the form of a story makes all the difference in the world.
John, who were your other influencers growing up?
There's no question that at the top of the list would be Mom and Dad. They were just extraordinary human beings to watch. And I've often thought, what is the greatest gift that they ever gave to me? And the gift is how they treated each other, and then how they treated other people. Not just my brothers and sisters, but how they treated me, how they treated friends, how they treated poor people, how they treated people who were less fortunate, and how the both of them were willing to lose so-called friends in order to do the right thing. And that happened in the 50s when we moved down here from Boston to the West Palm Beach area. One of our neighbors was very upset with my mother because we were going to have an event at our house, and an African-American woman was coming to the house to help my mother get all ready for this. And this neighbor saw that the African-American woman was using our bathroom and was eating with us, and she was outraged over it. And my mother was very upset over her being outraged by it and said, these are my words, but I'm sorry, that's the way we are. And it was wonderful to see that to my mother and my father, it didn't matter who you were, it didn't matter whether you were rich or poor, whether you were smart or not smart, whether you were looked great or didn't look great, or what color you were, what religion you were, I can honestly say they didn't care. You were accepted. And that meant you were accepted in our bathrooms and you were accepted at our dinner table. And that had a major influence over me.
How important is that empathy to being an effective trial advocate?
Well, to me, it's everything, because it allows me to speak from the heart. There are many things about a case where you may have to look at notes, or you look at evidence, or you go through documents, or you explain to the jury what a given expert's testimony means. But at some point, you shove all of those things that you're looking at aside, and you just look the jurors in the eyes, and you speak from the heart. And when you have lived through certain things in your life, it better prepares you to speak from the heart.
Having Al J. Cohn as a first boss, and I'm sure a mentor, was a very significant part of your legal upbringing. Tell us how you went about honing your trial skills, especially in that first job.
Well, I would say more than anything else, by watching and listening. And I did pay close attention to what people like Al Cohn, what they would do, what they would say, how they would do it, how they would say it. And I was, so to speak, you know, balancing on every word coming out of his mouth. You see, when I was in law school, I wrote a handwritten letter to Al Cohn, which I made a copy of. And it starts off, "Dear Mr. Cohn, more than anything else in the world, I want to come to work for your law firm." And I explained to him that my resume was that I was a high school graduate, a college graduate, and a law school graduate, and there were no awards, that I played sports, that I was going into the Marine Corps and still had to go in the Marine Corps after I would take the bar exam and pass it. And I said, if you would just hire me and give me a chance, I feel so confident that things will work out. I will come to work for you for free for the first 6 months, and then if it doesn't work out, you can let me go and I'll understand. I have that letter. In fact, I've handed that letter out to all of our young lawyers here at the firm so that each one of them could read that letter. Al Cohn sent me a telegram and said, wow. It said, deal. That was it.
Short and sweet.
It was addressed to me. Wow. It was a Western Union telegram. The year was 1974, and it said, 1973. It was July, August of 73, right in there. And it said, John Deal Al Cohn.
Wow.
That was the telegram.
Wow.
And then I met Al Cohn, and he was extraordinary. And I just adored him. He had been a World War II hero who landed at Normandy and was a company commander and just extraordinary. And a great, great trial lawyer, very imaginative, as innovative as someone could be, and just a wonderful, caring human being.
What lessons did Al Cohn teach you?
I would say lesson number one was effort is more important than results. His feeling was, if you take everything that you learn and you put forth 100% effort and you've paid attention and you do it the right way, the results will be there. But don't let fear of a bad result prevent you from putting forth the effort, because a lot of lawyers do that. They're so afraid of losing a trial because they'll be embarrassed, they'll be humiliated, they'll lose money or whatever, that they don't ever want to go to trial. And he said, think of the effort of the greatest baseball players ever. They strike out, they ground out, they fly out, and yes, 3 or 4 times out of 10, that's it. They'll get a hit. And he said, but it's the effort that makes a difference. Another thing that I saw in Al Cohn was he was maybe the most, I'm going to make up a word here, but includingest person I ever met. Some people say inclusive. Some people come up with other language. But he made it a point to put his arms around everybody he could to include him or her in everything that he was doing. And he wanted everybody to share in the glory. He wanted everybody to share in the fun. He wanted everybody to put forth the effort and to make the sacrifice to make things work. But he wanted everybody involved. And if theoretically you're running up the hill and somebody starts falling behind, Al Cohn would be the first to run back, grab that person by the belt, and pull them up the hill. And that's the way he ran the law firm. That's the way he practiced law. That's the way he dealt with people. And it was extraordinary.
You run a very successful firm. You're not only a practicing attorney, but you run a very successful firm that on any given series of years has a top five award case. Tell us about how you balance that, because a lot of lawyers aren't business people. They're not managers. How have you applied, or have you, some of the lessons you learned from Mr. Cohn?
Well, number one, in my life, my wife, Nancy, comes first. My family is there at the top. And whatever it is that I'm doing, I always have on my mind, if it's going to be good for my wife and children, it will be good for me. If it's good for my wife and my children and me, it'll be good for my clients. If it's good for all of us, it'll be good for my staff. If it's good for my staff, it'll be good for my staff's family, and so on and so forth. And that's the way I have always approached it. I tell young lawyers, work hard and look in the mirror and be able to say, I can't work any harder. I can't put forth a better effort. I can't go at it any harder. Then you'll go to sleep at night knowing you did the best you can absolutely do for yourself, for your family, for your entire team, for everyone. And to me, that is just a huge part of it. Now, I made it to my kids' events. I wanted to be there for every recital, every game. I wanted to go to the PTA meetings. If a teacher wanted to talk to us about one of the kids, I didn't want Nancy to go alone. I wanted to be there with her, and we made a point to do that.
And you have four children.
We have four kids, yeah. And yet, I have always worked what many people would just say are crazy, insane hours. And when I hear people say you can't do both, you can. And I did. I still do it. But I've never looked at it as work. I love it. This may surprise you. I loved boot camp in the Marine Corps. Most people cannot truthfully say that. I can truthfully say that. When football practice was over when I was a kid, I was disappointed. I wished it would have gone longer. I've always felt that way about things.
Why? Is it enthusiasm?
It is beyond belief enthusiasm. It is the love of doing things with people. I can't do anything alone. I'm serious. If you say to me, here, you can go have lunch anywhere you want, but nobody can have lunch with you, forget it. Give me a handful of peanuts. I don't want to go to lunch. I've never gone to the movies alone in my life, nor would I. I would never travel alone. I'm not critical of people who do that. I do get that people want space. John Romano wants no space. I don't want space. I love being with people and doing things all my waking hours.
And you talked about balance, and one of your colleagues really praises you for your ability to balance work and private life. That's very difficult for men to do, because unlike women, men tend to be compartmentalized, and there's some inherent conflicts in that, but it sounds like your life is one woven tapestry where one part feeds on the other and the other. And is that a fair description?
That is a fair description. I haven't heard it described that way before, but yeah, that's exactly what it is. And a big part of that, though, is my mom said the greatest thing that can ever happen to you in life is early on to fall in love with the right person. That happened to me, okay? Nancy and I are coming up, our next will be number 49, and people say, well, I guess your wedding day was the greatest day in your life, and I say, no, it's not the wedding, it's the falling in love that's the key. We don't even have to be married. I'm glad we are married, but it's the relationship. that makes the difference. And we support each other in everything. After our youngest graduated from high school, when Ryan finished high school, went off to college, I had been talking to Nancy. I said, why don't you come on to work for the firm? And then what we'll do is we'll have things set up so that for all the trials, you go with me. We work together. When I go on deposition trips, when I go to hearings in West Virginia and Chicago and New York, we go together. And we've done that. So that's been really, really special
and
fun.
Brought the kids with you?
Well, we until they went off to college, we took the kids everywhere. We took them to every FJA meeting, the annual meetings.
Okay, yes.
And AAJ at the time was called ATLA, the Association of Trial Lawyers of America. Great meetings. We'd take them with us to all of those meetings. We involved. I can honestly say my wife and kids and myself together as a family, we're somewhat raised in FJA. We have done it together.
Well, it's no wonder two of your four sons are attorneys, and one is very actively involved in the Florida Justice Association. Before we get into that, though, you're obviously a very positive person. You're a very enthusiastic person. This is a tough business, though. How do you handle disappointment?
The best way to handle disappointment, because there are things that I'm disappointed in. The biggest disappointment is when you do something and you're disappointed in yourself. It's big when you're disappointed in someone else who you may rely upon or trust, and maybe they don't do what you feel they perhaps should have done. I'll be disappointed in the outcome. If I put my heart into a trial for 1 month and were to lose that trial, I'm disappointed in that. But I follow this motto, and I've followed this a long time. Four parts to this motto. Don't blame. Don't brag. Don't complain. Don't gossip. When there's a disappointment, I never start looking around. Who can I blame? I try to figure out what happened and why as quickly as I can and get the negative out of my mind and my heart and figure, how do we turn this into something really good? And some people may say, well, that's unrealistic, or you're Pollyanna. And I say, well, I won't tell you the exact words I use, but I say, you're blank right. I am Pollyanna. I do look for the good in everybody. I look for the positive in every situation. And in my life, no matter what has gone wrong, no matter how horrible something may have happened, I still say, we're going to turn it into something positive. We can, we do, we always will.
And that's especially significant and admirable given what you've been exposed to in your legal career.
You will be amazed at how when you look at people, you can see things in them. And whenever you meet somebody, see only goodness and make them do something before you see anything other than goodness. And I've always felt a great part of life for me has been, I go on the assumption that everybody's good, that everybody has a big heart, that people are generous, they're caring, they're loving, they're kind, they're courteous. I go on that assumption, and they got to do something to change my feeling about them.
Prove you wrong.
That's right. And you know the great news is, they almost never prove me wrong. It turns out that is how most people are.
John, as we've mentioned, you've been heavily involved throughout your career with the Florida Justice Association. You're a former president back in 1989, 1990. You've won the Triple Crown, Perry Nichols Award, which is the FJA's most prestigious for the select few who set the standard for the rest of the trial bar to aspire to. You've won the B.J. Masterson Award for High Ethical Standards, the Al J. Cohn Award named after your first boss and mentor for lifetime achievement, a career of courage, leadership, devotion, setting the strong example, which Mr. Cohn did, by his actions and his practice of law. You are very much a teacher. You're a legend at the workhorse seminar that you give every year at the Florida Justice Association seminars, where you share strategies, you share techniques with younger lawyers. What impact has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association had on your career?
Well, it has for the better, not just changed my life in many ways, but it's just completely added to it. It's fueled it with even more energy. It has taught me all kinds of lessons. One of the greatest things is the people. It has brought me together with literally dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of people who I call my friends, people who I love, people who I rely upon, people who I trust, people who I want to be with, and my wife and my kids and I and our grandkids and all of us, we want to be with them. So the people part of it has been extraordinary. FJA, to me, though, has been the lifeblood of allowing plaintiff lawyers to represent clients so that we can obtain reasonable, sensible, and fair recoveries for these clients when they are wronged by other people. Sometimes those wrongdoers make an error, and it's neglect or negligence. Unfortunately, there are some times when the wrongdoing is intentional. It is evil behavior by someone. And FJA, by steadfastly being like a lighthouse that gives us comfort when we're out in the angry sea, that's what FJA has been to us, providing that lifeblood with all it does legislatively and all it does in teaching advocacy. We are better plaintiff lawyers in the state of Florida, more so because of FJA than for any other reason other than what we have learned through our mentors.
And as president of FJA in the years just prior to that, you were on the front lines of a very significant battle that involved the medical community in the state.
It did. It was, this takes us way back to 1988, and the Florida Medical Association placed a constitutional amendment ballot question up for vote. And it was a long, long spring, summer, and fall, gearing up for that battle, raising money, and putting the team together to defeat that horrible draconian measure that they were trying to pass.
And that was the cap they wanted, right?
On they damages. Wanted to cap non-economic damages on all cases at $100,000. And it came upon me to chair the campaign, which I jumped at. I mean, I was excited to do that. I thought that it was somewhat the equivalent of leading a team into the most challenging type of battle you could have. Not warfare type battle, but short of that. And it was an exciting several months there. And in the end, we defeated the ballot in a landslide. But that was hundreds and hundreds of debates by hundreds of people, raising millions and millions of dollars and everybody working very hard.
And that changed the course of trial law in the state of Florida.
It did. It did in many ways. And
by your ability to thwart it.
Yes. And it also brought the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers to a different way of thinking, because there were many who thought we as an organization are not capable of playing at that high a level and winning. I never for a split second doubted that we could do that. And there were many who were leaders within the organization who felt the same way. But sadly, we had doubters within the organization, and it took a lot of hard work to bring them around. And then finally, we made believers of them all.
John, we've talked about the law. Let's talk about ethics, especially in 2019. You've seen a change in law over the almost 40 years or 40 that you've been practicing. Do the ends sometimes justify the means?
No. When I was stationed at Camp Lejeune Marine Base, there were these signs, and it said, "Marines, there's never a wrong time to do the right thing." They were all over the place. Hmm. When it comes to ethics and the law, people know what's right and wrong. They know how to behave, and they often choose not to. I'm talking about the kind of misbehavior where people are deceitful, where there isn't a witness who simply comes to say what he or she saw, and a lawyer tries to intimidate that witness, to frighten that witness, to scare them. And the way they do it is by belittling them and humiliating them. Everybody knows that's wrong. And what I have seen is a faster-paced type of law that we practice. Now it's not only instantaneous because of email, text messaging, Dropbox, all these other ways of communicating. I see people getting angry, like, "I don't understand why you're ignoring me. I sent you the email 3 minutes ago." I'm exaggerating a little, but we see that. And I think that that intensification in the speed of communication is changing people, and they're behaving in a different way. Hmm. I know people who I've known for 40 years who have never spoken an unkind word, who are maniacs on social media with their blistering rhetoric directed towards other people. And you see these things and go, "Oh my goodness."
Do you have other concerns about the future of the legal profession?
Well, I'm always concerned about it, because I always want a legal system where people know that if someone has been wronged, they can seek justice and obtain justice without it being too expensive, without it taking too long. What happens now is we are in a time where we're seeing people who recently can be appointed to the bench, where these individuals may have never taken a deposition, tried a case, handled hearings. They never had to get down in the ditches and use a shovel in the practice of law, so to speak. And I want judges, at least trial court judges, who know what it means to be a trial lawyer and to know what it means to represent real people in real situations. And that will vary. So I'm not saying every judge has to have gone through whatever I've gone through or led my life. I don't say that at all. Right. But they have to be qualified to become a judge, as opposed to being somebody's friend or a political ally or a fundraiser.
What would be one piece of advice you would have for incoming lawyers?
If it's a new lawyer, I would say let your conscience be your guide. Because if you follow these mottos of doing right by people, treating people right, being decent to people, you'll be fine. Your clients will be fine. You'll make plenty of money. You'll do well. You'll be successful. It's when you get off onto these side agendas in life and you start going down the wrong track, it can lead to disaster.
John, how would you like to be remembered?
Wow. Being remembered, it's a lot about who's going to remember you and what is it that you want them to think about you? And I would say, first and foremost, that would be my wife, my children, my daughters-in-law, and my grandkids. And I would want them to say, he was a very caring, loving, kind husband and father and granddad and father-in-law. And I would want them to say he was a wonderful son.
John Romano, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.